We've got some cool stuff to talk about this week, starting with Apple Music. A couple of updates here. So, Mayo, what's new in Apple Music this week?
Yeah, so I definitely complained about this on the show, but this was 2-3 years ago now. In that, when I, because I joined Apple Music late, I was a late comer. I joined the Apple Music service when I got the HomePod, so that was February 2018. And obviously, the HomePod doesn't support anything else but Apple Music. More on that later. But it meant that I had to get Apple Music, so it was fine or whatever. But then I was running the Apple Music app, and I was running the free Spotify trial just to kind of compare the two side by side at the time.
Oh, because that was like your first time even doing a streaming music subscription.
Yeah. Because before that, I just basically just, because we weren't like big music listeners really, so we just buy some albums on iTunes and just play that basically.
Yeah.
And when I was comparing like Spotify and Apple Music side by side, there was like much of a muchness. But one of the things that I saw that Spotify was really much better at was just their like artist pages were way more organized and way cleaner. And my like canonical example was the page for Ed Sheeran, because he has done so many like deluxe versions and covers and remixes and stuff that if you went on Apple Music, each one would be its own little thumbnail. You'd have separate EPs for every track. You'd have five different thumbnails all with the same art, because it would be like the deluxe version of this, the censored version of this, the uncensored version of this, the EP of this. And so you'd have like Divide would have five entries of just almost exactly the same thing, but it would be so cluttered. If you do five times, he had like five albums. That was like 30 things. Just it was so overwhelming. And then you went and looked at the Spotify interface, and they'd actually like curated it down to here's a what any sane person would actually call his albums. And if you had to dig in a lot deeper to find all the other stuff that, you know, was still offered on the service, but it was cleverly grouped behind everything else and separated out, and singles and EPs were different to albums, right? And I'd say in early 2019, they addressed part of this problem in Apple Music, because they started putting a more heavy hand in curating the artist pages so that singles and EPs were separated from actual albums, and the albums were listed above. So that filtered out quite a lot of the nonsense, and it cut, you know, 30 things down to 10 things. But you would still see duplicate options for like the normal album and then the deluxe version, or the normal album and then the censored version, or the uncensored version, the explicit tracks. And what they've done this week is gone the extra steps, and now it is exactly like what the Spotify experience has been for, you know, 5 years or forever. And so now in Apple Music, they are grouping, they default to the deluxe version, which makes sense because that's the one with the most tracks on it.
The most, right.
Yeah, and in 99% of cases, the deluxe version is the superset of the normal album, right? Mm-hmm. It has more than one.
Everything and more, usually newer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so now what they're doing is you don't see by default the non-deluxe albums anymore. They choose censored or uncensored as well, and so you only see like the deluxe uncensored version, for instance. I think the censored or uncensoring depends on your system preferences setting, where it says, do you want to show explicit content or not?
Mm-hmm.
But it basically means now, when you go to like Ed Sheeran's page and see what his albums are, you only see his four actual albums, right? And if you click on them, you can scroll to the bottom and you can see the other version section, which is what's brand new here. And that's where you can obviously choose if you really want to go out of your way and not pick the deluxe version, or you want to pick the live version. And they've done this other stuff as well, like the very popular track at the moment is the Tones and I single Dance Monkey, because when this came out, I was just like picking stuff on the charts to try and see what they'd done. And now if you go onto the Tones and I single for Dance Monkey, you can go to the bottom, and the other versions give you a direct link to the strip back version, or the kind of orchestra version, or the live version. So it applies to like singles as well as albums as well. And it's just, you know, it actually feels like there's like human control over the servers, and it isn't just this like endless pile of everything just being submitted and submitted and submitted. You know, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that's cool. I haven't like browsed and discovered it on my own yet, but it's definitely neat. And even from like a not looking for a big mess perspective, but you just want to find everything and discover everything from one artist, finding other versions, like having it clearly labeled as other versions of this, and letting you say, okay, I've experienced this whole thing, let me go and see what are the differences here, if anything, is neat. Because I do like to, if I have an artist, I like to add everything from that artist, but also I want good organization where it isn't overwhelming to see, you know, they've got 100 tracks because like half of them are the same version of something in a different way. So it's nice to see that.
The EP was definitely like the biggest problems, where they'd have a dedicated quote unquote album listing for every single track in the album, but then, you know, artists don't make custom art for each song, so they use the same album art for everything, plus you'd have the album, so then you'd be looking at like a page of 8 different things that all have the same icon. It was really annoying.
Yeah.
So they managed to strip it all back properly and completely, and definitely a big tick on something I complained about like 3 years ago.
Yeah, which only took about like 5 years from whenever Apple bought Beats Music and turned it into Apple
Music. Yeah, because that's the thing here, is that the other version stuff, that's what Beats Music did when it was available, and obviously Apple bought Beats Music, but, you know, they didn't. Unfortunately, not all of the best parts of Beats Music made their way into the Apple Music transition. Like, most of their Beats Music features is kind of left on the cutting room floor.
That's right. And
only now have they finally, like, added some stuff back in.
Yeah, Beats Music had a feature called The Sentence, where you would pick, like, a few keywords and make a phrase, and then it would be, like, a custom playlist based on, you know, your mood and setting and everything, and they never pick that back up. You know, even if they use something from behind the scenes of that, that's like
obviously Beats Music was US only and didn't exist for very long before Apple
bought it, 3 or 4 months, right?
Yeah. But The Sentence was pretty cool twist on, you know, just a list of algorithmic generated playlists. It was almost like Mad Libs, wasn't it? It was like you had this sentence, and there was like 4 placeholders, and you could pick. And you basically just refine down a playlist for that mood. So it was like, you know, I'm having fun and I want to go out and play music for the evening or whatever. And you could, it's a dressed up version of filtering for the playlists that are actually in Apple Music. Because you can go into every like genre of Apple Music, and there's subcategories for pop and pure and workout. And it's just a different way of exposing that in, you know, a nice interface. And they never brought that over, which is a shame.
Yeah, but the one thing is like the onboarding for Apple Music,
Which
you only see when you're onboarding, but you've got these big circles that you tap of your favorite art, like who you like the most, artists and genres and things like that. That was a Beats Music feature.
UI.
Yeah. And now it looks kind of dated.
What's weird about that onboarding experience is that you'd assume that it's like synced to your account. But I, in the last like week or so, just had like a separate test device that I logged into my Apple ID with. And when I went into the music app, it showed me that same launch experience as if I'd never done it before. It
was weird.
Pick your favorite artist, pick your favorite genre. It's like, you know, I definitely have submitted this form before. Do you not remember that from last time? If I type it in here and press next, am I going to override my other choices? Like, I'm never quite sure what that, you know, initial onboarding actually influences really, but.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like a threshold that you need to hit of enough influence. It needs to know enough about you, whether it's based on iTunes purchases as like part of it with the old Genius Data listening history, and then also that. And so you keep triggering it because you don't have enough history yet, maybe.
Potentially.
Yep. There's some other new stuff in Apple Music this week, too. And this comes in the form of the macOS beta. The unreleased version of Catalina for developers and public beta testers, where the Apple Music app on the Mac now has the linked the time synced lyrics feature, right?
Yeah, so this is macOS 10.15.4 beta 2, because we saw all of the betas for the operating system coming out this week. And this wasn't in beta 1, interestingly, it's only in beta 2, where before, if you use the music app on the Mac, you would only get the old lyrics design, which is like, just like plain text.
Yeah, plain text list. Tiny text.
Yeah, exactly. You scroll it yourself. And now they've ported over the thing that was introduced for iOS and tvOS with iOS 13 and tvOS 13, where each individual line of the track follows along with what you're saying. And if you jump ahead, it catches up and you can like tap a line of the lyrics and it will jump the song across. And obviously for them to do that, they have to like maintain a database of lyrics. And I think Eddie Q said they've got like a big team of contractors that are basically doing this as fast as they can. They're trying to do as many songs as possible.
Yeah.
It's not everything. Like obviously we're, you know, 4 to 5 months into iOS 13 being, you know, out to everybody. And you can definitely still quite easily hit songs that don't have the time sync lyric stuff, but the penetration of the coverage is pretty high. I found like basically anything that you're going to see that's new has time sync lyrics, which is nice.
Yep. Yeah, this is nice because whenever you break up iTunes and then you've got the music app and the podcast app and the TV app, as they're sort of inspired by the iPhone and iPad apps on their own, then you'd hope that you'd have feature parity if you know, if there aren't Mac features on the iPhone, oh well, but that you at least have to have the iPhone features on the Mac, because it's kind of like, that's like the lowest common denominator. But, and so it was disappointing to see that you didn't have this before, that it was just like, okay, we've got music now, you know, new name and everything, and it's a little bit different looking, but it doesn't have the same features as the mobile version. And this is a pretty big step in getting it caught up with
yeah, because like music was basically a rename of iTunes.
Yeah.
It's not a new app. It's not a Catalyst app. It's not, you know, it's not a new share code base. It's just they took iTunes and they got rid of
stripped
stuff
out
that wasn't about music.
Most exactly. Of it, yeah.
And so to do this time sync lyrics features, they've had to have engineers, you know, re-implement it essentially and remake it in a, you know, in an AppKit landscape. And I'm sure that was not insignificant amount of work to do, but I'm glad to see that they've done it. Something that's really subtle in this like current beta cycle is the actual like best version of the time sync lyrics up to this latest round of betas, as in like iOS 13.4, was actually on Apple TV. They had the most feature rich version of the time sync lyrics because they would include the like the preamble indicator. So say if a song starts with just like an instrumental and the singer doesn't come in for like 30 seconds or whatever, it would have a little like indicator, like three dots, and it would like count in when the person starts speaking. But that was only on the Apple TV. And then in iOS 13.4, that has come to the iPhone as well. So they're finally getting it around. And I did check the macOS 10.15.4 implementation does include the little preamble symbol as well. So
cool.
They finally caught up feature parity across all three.
That's nice, yeah.
It's just kind of funny how like the Apple TV actually had something that the iPhone didn't.
Yeah, tvOS is where innovation happens, you know, Apple TV.
Yeah, to their credit, the real-time lyrics on Apple TV work really well. It's really nice.
That's a really cool place for that feature to be, is in a sort of a karaoke environment. You know, you can look at it and sing along. And, you know, my daughter is almost 7, and she's at the age where she's reading now, and she loves music. And so to be able to read the lyrics to music, something that she's really good at that I'm not good at, is to decipher the words of the lyrics and know exactly what the words are.
Yeah, I really struggle with that. Like, a lot of time I don't really know what a song's talking about unless I actually go and look it up.
I like the music and I like the sound and I hope I like the message, but it doesn't matter because I'm not sure what it's saying. And I'll hear her like sing songs back and then she knows what the lyrics are. But then now she's able to, she's on her iPhone looking, and she asked me the day, how do you find the lyrics? And I showed her the icon. But she loves that, just like reading it as it goes on the song, and then she sings along to it. So it's a really cool feature. So it's cool to be in the Mac, because anytime you've got a cool feature like that on the iPhone, you want it to be in the Mac too, because like the Mac is the biggest of all of them in terms of power. Like, why not? So
yeah, I mean, it should be the most capable.
right. At least. Yeah. And I saw that, you know, and this feature comes from, at least in part, from Apple buying Shazam last year or so. Because they were doing this in their app, then it went away, then it came back. And then I think as of this week, Spotify is offering either the same or a similar feature for subscribers too.
Yeah, I think because Spotify, Apple's obviously with their you know, latest initiative, they've hired their own like contracting team, kind of how they have a contracting team correcting Siri problems, or they're the team correcting mistakes in Apple Maps. So they have like, you know, it's essentially just a big manual labor job of having to write down lyrics, because there's no like canonical source of lyrics with the time data attached. And so it's actually quite a big ordeal for companies to do this, which is why you don't see every streaming service just doing it off the cuff. Spotify did have a licensing deal with Music's Match, which offered a feature like this back in like 5 years ago, right? But then the license deal ended, so then the feature went away.
Yeah.
And I think they've renegotiated the deal again, probably pressured by the fact that Apple's doing it now, and it was a nice play for Apple Music. And so Spotify's coming back with a very similar feature soon. Yeah,
cool. All right, let's talk about Apple's earning guidance revision. And this is similar to news last year, where Apple, on an earnings call and a release, they provide a forecast of what they expect to earn in the next quarter, a range of certain tens of millions or billions of dollars.
Yeah, billions.
Billions of dollars per quarter. So we think you're going to make between like $40 and $50 billion, you know, a more specific number than that, for revenue. And ideally, Apple either exceeds that or they hit the high end of that or they at least don't miss it. And if
they should be somewhere between the big number and the small number.
Right. And so last year there was an episode where Apple learned that they were going to miss the low number by a lot. And so they had to give a correction and it was a huge deal. This month, we've got a similar situation where they don't know what they're going to hit, what the numbers are going to be, but they don't believe it's going to be what their guidance was. So it's another guidance revision. Only this time it's not because it's strictly just economic reasons and iPhone performance, but it's because of the coronavirus, right?
Yeah, so when this happened in the holiday quarter of last year, you had the tariff war stuff affecting Chinese demand, plus you had the Chinese economy being weak, plus you had Apple's product lineup not being the most compelling that it's ever been, right? And we obviously saw them reel from that with the stuff like the trade-in programs and the offers and the new iPhone XR from $449 banners that we saw everywhere. And they're loving the trade-in program stuff. They keep doing it and they keep rolling out even more aggressively. And now they've had the Apple Card, zero monthly payment stuff. And if you remember before 2018, Apple was only like advertising iPhones. They're like full price. So, you know, $799, $749, $999. And in the aftermath of them missing their sales in that period, it made them shift back to a market strategy where, again, they try and give monthly pricing because it's all on installment plans again, whether you're trading in and you're paying month to month or you're using like the carrier subsidy stuff, like it's all back to from $29.99 per month. So that was definitely one of the biggest things we saw in the wake of that, because Apple had to, it was like an onus on them to correct something wrong in their business, right? And that letter that Tim Cook released last year had that thing where it was like, we're going to make it easier for customers to trade in their new phone, to get financing for their purchase, and move data across. And we saw them systematically roll out policies and features to do exactly that over the course of last year. And then obviously when the iPhone 11 and 11 Pro came out, they, you know, switched out their marketing a lot. They made the price of the iPhone 11 $50 cheaper. They did a lot of things that were very much a direct consequence of them missing their revenue guidance for the holiday quarter, which would technically be Q1 2019. Mm-hmm. And at that point, that was the first time they'd done that in like 14 years, because the time before they'd missed their guidance was back before Apple made iPhones. It was like 2002, right? It was just the beginning of the iPod era. It's a completely different time. Uncomparable since the meteoric rise of the company. So it was a big problem. And now, only 1 year later, we have the same situation where they guided $62 to $67 billion in revenue for what is the current quarter, so January through March, right? And that is actually a wider range than normal anyway, because they obviously, the coronavirus stuff was, you know, happening when they did release their news report a couple of weeks back.
That's right. Yeah.
And normally Apple's revenue range is like $3 billion. So it'll be like 60 to 63 or 50 to 53. And they specifically addressed that they were giving a wider than normal range, 62 to 67, because they were unsure exactly how the coronavirus stuff were playing out. So they were giving themselves this bigger window to, you know, to account for the variance and the uncertainty. Right. And what has transpired is that despite even giving that bigger range, they think they're even going to miss that. So it's going to be sub $62 billion in revenue is basically what has had to cause them to release this new letter.
Yeah.
And with the coronavirus, you have kind of problems on demand and the supply side. On the supply side, it means that there were big factories that weren't pumping out iPhones. And so you have supply chain constraints and you can't sell phones that don't exist, right? So you have problems in making the phones and selling them through. And we've seen some analysts say that the two week halt of production, it might take them to like June to fully resolve, or, you know, it's despite only being off for 2 weeks, it's a longer than 2 week problem to solve, because you're always going to be 2 weeks behind, right? And you can't just spring up another factory for a month. So it's a complicated ordeal when you're missing production of millions of iPhones, even for a fortnight essentially. And then you have the demand side problem or impact where in China, Apple had to shut down their retail stores. Chinese people, frankly, aren't leaving their homes very much, right? And so that has weaknesses on sales because it means that people in China are probably not buying iPhones at the same rate that they would normally. They're spending it on, you know, essentials and food, or they're just not buying anything because, you know, they're quote-unquote stuck in their homes, right? So there's kind of like two things at play there. It is kind of weird that they tried to account for this, but then it's actually been so bad that they got it wrong.
Yeah, and so and they were early enough in that they couldn't give a new number, right? Unless they knew more last time with the correction than they do this time. This time it's just, we're not going to hit that number. We don't know what it will be.
And they didn't give new guidance this time around.
Yeah.
And I think that's mostly just due to the timing of when they're releasing the statement, because last year it was the holiday quarter, so October, November, December, and they report at the end of January, right, for the holiday quarter.
Almost all the data was in.
Yeah, so basically all the data was in when they said they were going to miss their guidance, because they released that statement on like January 2nd. So for the most part, they basically had all their numbers already. So that, I think, meant that they had to release the accurate numbers they had at the time. Whereas this statement is we're only in mid of February, and the quarter continues through the end of March. So I think that's why they didn't give any numbers at all now, whereas they did before, just because it's so soon into the thing that they don't even have better numbers to give. It would just be like making stuff up, right?
And so the closer to that 63 billion number they get is the better. And also you could imagine the attention span being limited, and by the time you get to the March numbers being reported, that if Corona is contained by then and it's no longer in the news and it's been out of the news for a while, you know, that's best case scenario, then you could be like, oh, that's just an excuse. That was contained a long time ago. By giving the update now, we're going to miss that, you know, we already know, then it's no surprise in a few months when they end up reporting these numbers out.
Yeah, it's probably better to say it early than later, because like you said, if they said it, like, if they missed their numbers in April and they were like, oh, it's because of the coronavirus, people are like, oh, yeah, you're just saying that word. Right, you know what I mean? Right. Whereas if they actually say it now, while we're still in the midst of a lot of factories not operating,
and it is taking longer than anyone had expected for this to go away, right?
Yeah, for people to get back on their feet and start, you know, going back to work or whatever. And I it is kind of funny that it is like now the second time in as many years that it's happened, but there definitely isn't the same level of like pressure and concern from, you know, the tech community and the investor community about this time, because people are like, okay, Apple, right? You know, you may be the biggest company in the world, but you can't predict, you know, global health outbreaks and their exact consequences down to the letter, right?
That's so right. I mean, there is concern that there's too much dependence on China. That was the same problem as last time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even if this becomes, even if the virus can spread globally, it's the supply chain in China. And there's been some movement around changing that a little bit, but not by much. But so you can apply those lessons again. But last time it was more like, you know, literal misguidance and missteps, because there were so many things that could be done to correct it that then it's like, okay, if we would have done that, we might have prevented this from happening. This time, it's not that Apple could have made a new program, you know, it's a health investment, and not a strategic one. So it's
when you read the Tim Cook letters in both cases, the 2019 one ends with Apple, like, with him basically saying, you know, yes, there are economic weaknesses in the market, but also Apple as a business can do this and this.
Yeah.
Whereas this one basically ends with saying, you know, Apple's underlying business is strong, we just got to wait out the public health crisis.
Yeah, right? The best we can do is try to help mankind fight this.
Yeah, and they obviously like doubled their donation to charities and everything.
Yeah.
But at a fundamental level, they don't see it as a problem on themselves, and they kind of back that up by saying, you know, demand in every other part of the country is very, very strong and better than ever and whatever.
So
it's definitely like funny that it's happened again, but it's by no means as dire or as catastrophic as it was last year.
And they also fully recovered from the last one. I mean, like, they earned everything they lost back and then some, you know. And
yeah, and their stock price is like double what it was at the lows of last year. So
yeah,
they're not doing too badly. I think if you look at iPhone sales, we're probably still not actually that much. Like, they've kind of gone nowhere for 3 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem like the iPhone 11 series is doing well, and their trajectory is, you know, positive at least. It's, like, it was kind of crazy that they literally had one quarter last year where iPhone revenue was down 20% because of the China stuff. But in the successive quarters, as a combination of reducing prices, doing the trade-in program stuff, more promotions, and the economy just getting, you know, stronger overall, that minus 15% has gone back to basically like 0%, right? So they're not, you know, they're not shrinking anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And so that's Corona related. There is some questions about how will this affect the product cycle this year. And so we've got some new reporting from a few different sources on what to expect this year in regards to that. So what's new from Bloomberg on the iPhone SE 2 first?
Yeah, so coronavirus is recovering, but it's still definitely a big question mark of what is to come. And for Bloomberg, there was a report this week that said that the iPhone SE 2 is still on track for a March release. So we should be seeing that anytime now. And we think, again, it's going to be exactly like an iPhone 8. There was some, you know, spurious leaks this week, supposedly looking at this thing that had like square sides, but, you know, it wasn't real. It was just like a Chinese shell of... That's kind of funny. Like, it was a Chinese shell of what the iPhone 12 is going to look like. But, you know, Chinese companies make all sorts of stuff so far ahead just to make it feel like you've got a new phone. But then someone had taken that shell and saying it was the iPhone 9 or the iPhone SE 2, which is just not true, right? Like, the thing that's coming out in March is going to look like an iPhone 8, is going to have a newer processor, and it might have a better camera, right? That's basically the iPhone SE 2 equation, and it's probably going to cost $399, which is a repeat of their original iPhone SE strategy. And then Bloomberg says that there's going to be a new iPad Pro in the first half of the year, despite the production delays from the coronavirus stuff. They think it's going to be the first half of the year and not the second. Digitimes followed up on that by having a similar report saying there'd be a new iPad Pro in the first half of the year. They interestingly described it as a 12-inch tablet.
Hmm.
And if you get into the weeds, well, obviously the iPad Pro is currently offered in 11 inches and 12.9 inches, not 12. But because Digitimes is like a Chinese translated publication, you're never entirely sure whether they're actually trying to say, oh, it's actually going to be 12 inches now, or if they just kind of, like, typoed it, right? Like,
sure, yeah. You got lost along the way, right?
Yeah, like, we haven't heard other people say the sizes are going to change. And 11 and 12.9 are already kind of at the limit, I think, of the difference in screen size you could have to make, a differentiated product line. Like, if they were going to move to 12 inches, I'd almost say they were going to replace, like, the two products with one. Because... are you really going to have 12 and 11 and 12 and 12.9?
It's
too close.
Yeah. I think that going to 12 would be too bad, because with the 12.9-inch form factor with like really slim bezels, they've nailed it. It's an awesome product, and I would take one that's even bigger. But because it's Digitimes, like if it was a Ming-Chi Kuo rumor that you know, it's 12 inches now, you're going to see 11 and 12.9 go away and it's going to be 12 from now on, then I'd have to think a lot more about it. But because of the context here, I'm with you. I think it's probably just a generalization right now and not a direction wise, but even so, like the idea of having the iPad Pro finally replaced this in the first half of this year, when there was no new one last year, the one before that, the most recent one from 2018, that's such a good iPad Pro that, mm-hmm. You know, I would not regret buying the same one again right now, because it's so good. And there's not like, It's not like where sometimes like the iPhone can feel super old and or Macs need to be updated. It's like that iPad Pro,
the hardware does not feel old.
Yeah, right. The hardware is awesome, and they've gotten a lot of miles out of that, and they could keep going. And you could see like the newer version being subtly different, but not a whole lot different, you know, because of just how good that is.
The rumors are basically saying it's going to be a spec bump, plus it's going to get like the triple camera system, and probably will have the rear time of flight 3D sensor stuff, which we expect to also see in the full iPhones. And so that's kind of like putting Face ID on the back, because it'll let the phone do like precise depth mapping of the nearby objects, which will presumably have some kind of like augmented reality purpose or something of that nature. Or maybe it would just be for like really nice portrait photos. But That's kind of like the level of what we're expecting from this iPad Pro revision, which is perfectly fine. You know, they did a big overhaul with the 2018 version, mm-hmm. and a small spec bank update is perfectly fine for that product at this time.
One thing I do wonder about that, though, is that, you know, there is the idea that we think this will have 5G for the cellular version, because it's been rumored and they've done that before with iPads where it gets the new version of cellular before the iPhone does, as sort of a test bed. But what about the processor? So if would it get the same chip as the iPhone 11 or modified version of that? And then would the iPhone 11 successor has be better in a different way? Because I know in the years past they've done like an X version where the graphics are better on the iPad version, but then speed-wise, is it? Do you think that's a concern, that, or should they wait until after the new iPhone comes out if they want to do a next generation chip, like, you know, same version number as the iPhone?
They'll probably brand it as this current generation's with an X on the end, but then the performance characteristics can be whatever they want, right? They can flounce the full iPhone in graphics and CPU just by putting the X on the end. It doesn't really matter what the number is, right? If they give a number that's the same as the current number, which I think is 13, right?
I think so. So I'm not using anything because it's lost on me now.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's currently A13. So they can call it A13X, and it could be a completely different architecture under the covers. Right? Like, it's completely separated. And that will make people happy because, the A14's brand new in the iPhone in the September. But, you know, it's not the first time they would have chips released earlier that are way faster than what comes after. Like, if you go to the 2017 iPad Pro, that was an A10X Fusion chip, right? But its graphics performance and its CPU performance is way ahead of the A11 that ended up in the iPhone of that year, right? And that's kind of the thing with the Apple TV 4K, right? The A10X graphics are faster than an A12's graphics, right? So, just a normal A12, not anything else, not like an X or any variant, right? So, just the plain A12 that turned up in the iPhone of that generation, an A10X is faster than it. So, if you're just talking about making a new Apple TV with an A12 chip, you'd actually be doing a downgrade on graphics performance. So, you know, Apple has these nice, you know, monotonically increasing numbers, but if you actually look at the details of the chips themselves, they vary greatly, and they just tune it to whatever hardware they need for that time for that device. And yeah, there are some rumors that we might see 5G in the spring for the iPad. There's also some people saying that they'll release this new iPad without 5G, and then there'll be like 5G variants in the fall, which I could also see happening. So it'd be like the exact same iPad that comes out in the spring, but they also just have 5G cellular, right? Which is possible. So that kind of thing, they can't just hack it on at the end. But if you're building the product from the beginning with 5G in mind, then you've got like the platform ready to just add it on as a variant down, 6 months later.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool. And then Ming-Chi Kuo does have some things to say about the AirTags or the Tile competitors, the ultra wideband tags that we first reported, and their availability sometime this year.
Yeah. So if you remember, we talked about a Kuo story last week where he said there were going to be a smaller wireless charging mat, Apple headphones, and the UWB tags coming at some point in this year, although they might be the exact schedules were originally going to be for the first half of the year, but because of the production holdups and Apple's not sending engineers to China at the moment, that stuff's kind of like a bit more loosey-goosey on exactly when it's being nailed down. This week he had a report that the supply chain side, so the people that make the chips that will go into the AirTag chips, are set to ramp up production for Q3, which, you know, you kind of have to like proxy it out and extrapolate, but that kind of implies that the AirTags will come out in September, probably alongside the iPhone 12 series, right? I think that's probably reasonable. What you might see, because Apple, you know, when Apple's making a new product category, they don't have to worry about Osborne-ing or cannibalizing sales of anything else because they didn't make anything in that region before. So it can be very likely that they will announce it in June, and then it comes out in September, for instance, right? Like, and that tends to be what Kuo's saying here, where supply chain partners are ready to ramp up to full, you know, to full whack by August time. So basically, like the September iPhone event.
Yeah, and so we're nearing the end of February. This rumor that we first sort of, you know, circulated that Apple's working on these tags from 9to5 Mexi Rambo finding them. I began in like
April of last year.
April last year. So we're getting pretty close to a 1 year of this being kind of out in the open without anything from Apple yet. So it's interesting. All right.
Yeah. And the software is definitely getting, you know, ready for it. I think even in the latest betas, there was some minor like changes to the strings of exactly how this stuff is described. So they're definitely still working on it. You need to find software for your business, but you have other things to do, other things you'd probably rather be doing. Cut to the chase with Capterra, the website that millions of people use monthly to find software for their teams and their businesses. Capterra simplifies the software search to just a few easy steps, and they help you make the most of the tools you find. Use the filter options to drill down into what is relevant to your industry and compare tools side by side and save your favorites to a shortlist. Get started at capterra.com/happyhour. Capterra is the free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. Capterra helps your business thrive by making the software buying process as easy and effective as possible. With over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories, from project management to email marketing to even something like running your own yoga studio. They have it all. So how do you get started? Go to capterra.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web with endless searching. Capterra brings everything together into one simple-to-browse directory. Visit capterra.com/happyhour for free today and find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/happyhour. That's spelled Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/happyhour. Capterra, software selection simplified.
All right, Mayo, finally for this week, there's a big story from our friend Mark Gurman at Bloomberg about a possible feature change in iOS 14 coming later this year, which is the ability to finally be able to change your default mail and browser apps on the iPhone and iPad, just like you can on the Mac, but for the first time on mobile.
A revolution.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's like,
you can kind of see this as like they're coming up with features and they want to, you know, have another iOS 12 year where they've really nailed down the bugs and stability and everything. They're like, you know, we need some more features though. What's something that we can just kind of pull and that we've been working on for a while and it's a lot of work, but it's one of those finally features and this could be one of those things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I don't want to trivialize it too much because there's definitely like consideration design has to go into something like this.
Mm-hmm. You can see how it could be a part problem to solve.
Yeah. I think on terms of motivation, we kind of have to do address like the air of the political environment where everyone's talking about, you know, big tech being too big tech monopolizing their markets and abusing their power as both, you know, platform owner and platform member. So like this in the background of all this, you've got like Spotify complaining that Apple Music's too privileged on iOS compared to everything else. And, you know, Apple hasn't done default apps for 14 generations of iOS, and suddenly this year it's like, oh, it sounds like they're going to do it. And there's definitely like the air of pressure from, you know, governments and anti-competitive bodies to make like Apple's default apps not give them a leg up over what's available in the App Store so much.
And yeah, so far the
default apps is one part of that, of course, but it's not the whole story. I mean,
yeah.
You know, so default apps don't make 30% price differential disappear, but it's definitely a step in that direction.
Yeah, Apple's defense has sort of been, we have the App Store, so there are options. But then the default is a part of that. You could eventually see where, you know, someone complains that being pre-installed or not being pre-installed is an issue. And that's where it gets like to be kind of ugly and everything. But I don't think there's anything wrong consumer facing with changing your default app. As long as you've got good options that are not going to, you know, break the experience, then it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you can, hopefully we won't end up in a situation where it was like Microsoft Windows XP, where when you launched the web browser, it would say, do you want Internet Explorer or do you want Chrome or do you want Firefox? Or do you, you know, like that like internet ballot screen thing they had to do, which the EU mandated them do. Like, I know why that had to happen and stuff, but it was not very pretty and not very nice in terms of user experience, right? And
right.
Apple trying to get ahead of, like, this kind of feels like Apple's trying to get ahead of any over extensive legislation by saying, look, we are doing stuff, guys, right? We're not just being King Apple up on our pedestal and not responding to the complaints of the developer community. Look, we are giving these concessions away. You don't need to regulate us explicitly, because if that did happen, they might regulate stuff that Apple didn't like, and then you would end up with situations where there are bad things at play. So that's, you know, obviously we can never know for sure. Like, maybe Apple was always planning to do this and they finally got around to it, but it's definitely hard to call it exactly coincidental timing. I'm sure this kind of stuff was probably on the list of things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the air of the anti-competitive stuff has kind of bumped it up in terms of priority.
I mean, right? it does make the iPad feel more like a desktop computer, because there's a feature that you can do on a desktop computer. And then also, there are lots of ways that, like, you're if you use a suite of third-party apps, you know, like your Google Chrome can I believe look to open Gmail, and you can have, you know, links from Tweetbot and your Twitter client open in Chrome. Like, you can, there are ways to work around the system. So, like, clearly people want it because developers have made ways for you to do that. So regardless of,
I think of how many apps have a setting for open this in Safari versus open this in Chrome, but you just have like a per app setting in like 20 different apps.
Yeah, making that kind of a thing obsolete is good for users. It's good for developers, you know. And then, like you mentioned, it helps this whole antitrust environment for Apple.
Yeah, because I mean, if you look at what the Bloomberg report specifically mentions is Safari, Mail, and then maybe a preference for changing your default music service, and that would mainly come into play with like Siri. So on the iPhone, if you could change your default music service to say Spotify, then you could ask Siri to play music, and it would default to Spotify without you having to say Spotify's name every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Because in iOS 13, they added the audio domain for SiriKit, but it always prioritizes Apple Music unless you explicitly say the name of the app, which gets annoying very quickly. But just if you just look at like Apple Music and Spotify is like a whole separate, you know, fight actually, where there is, you know, hard money on the line on both sides. If you look at Safari and email, you know, Apple doesn't really care if you're using Safari or Chrome, right? Like, there's no financial connection to it, really, right? Like, they can let you have an alternative browser. It's they're not losing any money from it, right? Like, in the music case, making third-party music apps more competitive and better and more full-featured compared to the system Apple Music app, there is actually, like, a thing there where, you know, Apple is voluntarily making their products that they make money from less good, relatively, mm-hmm. right? Whereas if you look at the web browser, yes, I know Apple likes everyone to be using Safari, and I like Safari too, but, you know, if half of the iPhone user base uses Chrome, I don't think they're going to be in too much of a sweat about it.
Yeah, and, you know, if there's a reason that half are using Chrome, we've seen this on the Mac where people will like something from Chrome, so Safari will catch up with that feature, mm-hmm. you know, because they want to be competitive.
Yeah. And just if you go for a bit higher level for a sec, right? Let's say web browser. What does it mean to be a default web browser on iOS? Presumably, when you tap on a link, it opens in that web browser, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now look at email. What does it mean to be a default mail app on iOS?
If you tap a mail to button, it opens the email client.
Is that it? Because if you think about it, mail has privileges where it can fetch email regularly when a third-party app can't. Because, you know, when you go into settings and you go mail and you say fetch or push, and then it says, you know, what interval do you want to fetch mail? Every 15 minutes, every 30 minutes, once a day, once an hour, right? That granularity of setting is only available to Apple's mail app. It's not available to anything else. They have to go through the standard background APIs, which have no guarantees about how often you'll be called to, you know, refresh your inbox, right? So there's complexity there, right? I'm sure at the very least they'll offer it so when you click on a mail to link, it opens the right email app. But will they support the more complicated stuff like, you know, having the proper, you know, mail fetch every 30 minutes?
No.
Or, or when you press mail to, will it be able to, because right now when you say like share via mail and there's like a default mail share in an app, it brings up a system sheet which uses the mail app, right? will it support when you call that same API, will it support bringing up like a share extension specifically for the mail app of the third party app, or will it just like switch apps to the third party app? Like,
there's optimized more
complexity there than just immediately saying, oh, you just make it the default.
Right. And you can see for the second part, for how it opens up the compose window, whether it's the mail compose window or Gmail's compose window, you can see it being like an iOS 14 update, where if you're updated for iOS 14, mm-hmm. then it can be the new thing, but by default, it's going to be the old thing.
They probably have to do that anyway for all this stuff. It probably always require like some sort of, you know, you have to be on the iOS, and then you have to wait for your web browsers to update to iOS 14 to support it. Or and even on like the web browser stuff, so many apps now have Safari View Controller like integrated into them, so you get the kind of like embedded web browser experience. If you change your default app, should the embedded web view also change to something that's controlled by the third party app? Maybe. Like when you bring up the Safari View Controller in, say, like Twitter, it has a button in the bottom right, which looks like the Safari icon, and when you tap it, open Safari. But if you can suddenly set your system default to be Chrome, when you go into the Safari View Controller, you probably want that button to open Chrome. Like, there's more complexity than, you know, the surface level of, oh, you're just tapping on links or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously a big spectrum of what will actually Apple implement. The Bloomberg article does not have the detail to be able to like explicitly nail down exactly what it would mean, right? The Bloomberg article says final decisions have not been made, so everything's kind of still up in the air. But it seems like they're going to do something in that remit. And there's definitely a case for, if you just sort out mail to and links to go to the different apps, that probably addresses like a majority of people's complaints.
Yeah.
Right? So that's probably where they'd stop. But there is more. There's always more to do, right? Like, there's always that extra level of, you know, the system mail app does have more privileges than just any app from the App Store does.
Yeah, and then when you look at default apps in general, so the report specifically about browsers and email clients, but you could want the same thing for an easy one is Calendar, like mm-hmm. I do on the Mac. I use Fantastical as my default. You could say you want a default podcast player, a default image editor or photo library, you know, photo app. There's a lot of different things that you could want to replace as a default.
Default camera app.
Default camera app. It's a big one for iOS. Yeah. There's a lot of these, but it's so, from the report, it's just so far browsers and email apps, right?
Yeah. That's the two it calls out. It kind of like implies that maybe there'd be others, but it doesn't name any specific categories. And then on the music side, you've got the ability to change the, you know, the preferred music service for Siri, which should be a feature that they have for like all of SiriKit domain stuff. You should always be able to change your preference list regardless, right? It doesn't matter what all the categories and domains of SiriKit supports today, there should be a UI for you to say, I don't know, I actually want to use this app more than others, or it should learn, right? Like, that's just a feature. That's not, you know, that's not like holding them to the bridge. That's just like something sensible that they should do. And then another half of this report is also about the HomePod specifically. And interestingly, Mark Gurman says that Apple is considering to allow the HomePod to natively play other music services. So right now, you get Apple Music through Siri on the HomePod natively. But any other music service, you have to AirPlay from your phone or from another device, right? And so supposedly in this new era, you'd be able to install Spotify or Tidal or Pandora directly on the HomePod itself, and you could ask voice command questions to the HomePod directly, and it would start playing the music. You know, like the capabilities of every other smart speaker on the market.
Right.
But that's cool, though. And that would be a significant increase in the level of sophistication of what the HomePod can do in terms of third-party apps, because all of like the HomePod's third-party stuff today is all done through the phone. You know, it's funneled through the personal request system, which is, you know, relaying to the phone, and then you just hear the answer on the HomePod.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then when it comes to music, the music domain that they introduced with iOS 13 doesn't work with the HomePod at all. And this would be going even further than that, as well as just relaying from the phone, it's actually playing directly on the HomePod.
Yep. And so this year we got audiobook streaming on the Apple Watch with watchOS mm-hmm. 6, but you don't have that on the HomePod, right? It's still AirPlay is what's required, because I know when the HomePod first came out, they promoted it. You can use it as your iBooks audiobooks player. But
yeah, I don't use Apple's audiobooks really, so I couldn't tell you the time.
Yeah, I think that's all the case though, that only podcast and Apple Music come
that's
from.
That's kind of stupid.
Yeah, right. They've got
that's
the infrastructure.
The home right, it's right, great, right. And then there's these stupid edge cases.
Yeah.
Yeah, so audiobooks would be nice if that isn't there already. And obviously, presumably if they're talking about music services, that would be generalized enough to support third-party podcast apps as well.
You'd hope,
so you
yeah.
don't necessarily have to use Apple Podcasts on the home.
Yeah, and it's kind of like if Apple takes advantage of the Echo platform, being able to put Apple Music there or Apple Podcasts there, which is now a thing, then they should extend the same thing to their companies. You know, if they think there's value in that and they use it on other services, then they should offer it. Then
yeah, and that's why, you know, Apple and Amazon have a pretty healthy relationship now where Amazon stocks all their products, but the notable exception is they don't stock the HomePod because it doesn't support Amazon's music services.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so if they did, then they could actually sell the HomePod on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. And Spotify would have a lot fewer things to complain about antitrust-wise.
Yeah, because they added the Siri API for the iPhone last year, and if they add it to the HomePod as well, it starts pulling down, you know, Spotify's complaint to the EU quite considerably. Then the only thing that's kind of left is the business side of things with, you know, 30% cut stuff. But I think if you're Apple and you're like, what can we do to like show we care, even at a surface level, right? Would you rather change how much money you're making, or would you rather just let them have features on the OS?
Mm-hmm.
They're probably going to pick features, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to pick the system integration stuff and just loosen up slightly there, and then hopefully that'll be enough to make all the legal stuff go away, and then you can carry on collecting your 30%, right?
That's yeah, and then maybe you sell more HomePods, but I mean, that's not really the HomePod complaint. Is that it's $300? You know, it was $350, now it's $300.
Yeah, the HomePod will sell more when they have like a HomePod Mini.
Right,
like yeah, obviously some more people will buy it if it can play Spotify.
It sells more when it goes on sale.
Oh. Yeah, like there was some report by some analysts this week that like the HomePod had 5% of the smart speaker market last year. I actually think that's pretty respectable for a $300 speaker. Like.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it, you know, Apple's, it's still only in like the low millions of units over the entire year, which pales in comparison to literally like every other Apple product that exists. But I think it shows there's at least, you know, enough interest in there for them to actually be worth them bringing out a HomePod Mini of, you know, $900.
One yeah, million. You could
do a lot better.
You could guess it might be like less than 1%. So it'd be 5% or something. Yeah, you know, this week.
Yeah, like I promise you, of the Amazon and the Google stuff, 95% of it is just the $50
or under price. Free. Yeah. You know, yeah,
which is not a diss, right? That's clearly a product that people want, and
yeah,
they can put them in every single
Apple
room,
too.
And you can put them in the bathroom even, and you don't get worried that they're going to break, right? And Apple just doesn't have any product in that segment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been that way for a long time too. This week or last week, Pandora Radio did their streaming music app on the Apple Watch, where it works without the iPhone, and it's streaming over cellular. So Spotify did that too now, right?
Yeah, yeah. With WatchOS 6, they can do it.
Yeah. Why aren't they doing that yet? Then that's what I'm thinking. Is just like, you know, when I interact with like family and friends who don't use, you know, as many Apple services, or that they use Spotify because they get it, you know, at a discounted rate with college or things like that, then that's one of the complaints is, well, can't do Spotify and stream it on the watch, you know, or you know, that doesn't work with HomePods, and so it makes like my stuff seem foreign.
Yeah, because we talked about this, right? Because Spotify released their Apple Watch app in like October of last year.
Yeah,
after WatchOS 6 had come out, which actually supported actual music streaming.
They already
the
could
Spotify
have.
App was things. Just a remote.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Like Spotify's. I can understand where they're coming from in terms of like that they don't want to invest in a platform that they're currently like fighting in court, right? So I know it's like it's from the outside it's a bit childish where it's like, oh, you're not actually releasing updates that you could release, but it does kind of like cripple their argument if they're contorting themselves to conform to the current platform whilst also complaining about it so much, because
yeah.
then, you know, a juror or a judge can say, well, it can't be that bad if you're happily playing along, right? So they kind of do have to kind of take a stand for a while, which is like, look, we're just not going to do this stuff until until we get a resolution.
Yeah, but it's so close. Like, so for example, with Pandora, with CarPlay, maybe without CarPlay, but you can control Pandora with Siri, right?
Yeah.
And so,
on the iPhone and the iPad, you can, yeah.
Right. And then on the Apple Watch, you can stream without even having the phone. So it's you're really close to being able to do that. Like, it just needs to be a thing that you can do on the HomePod, because you've got the Siri part and you've got the app part. But just put that on HomePod.
Yeah, you just need the bit that the HomePod's missing is the ability for the app to live on the HomePod itself.
Right, so, right. It's
that, gotta... just, that infrastructure doesn't exist today. And adding it brings up a whole more questions about, well, how'd you do it? How'd you expose the UI for it? Where'd you do the settings for it? Where'd you have to log into your account?
And is it that you work privately with Apple, or is it that Apple provides the tools and anyone can do it? Like CarPlay used to be that way too, or you had to just work with Apple, and then they made it where anyone could submit a CarPlay app. But
yeah, exactly. And even with CarPlay, there's still a submission process where you have to go through like a separate channel to get approval, but it's just a lot more open now, where basically everyone gets in.
Yeah.
But first it was like, you know, you have to be like best friends with Tim Cook to actually be able to make a CarPlay experience.
They came to you first.
The issue with Amazon is obviously they have like the Alexa app, which houses all of those integrations with all the third-party skills and everything, which gives you that interface to set up like the stuff that runs on the device, essentially. Like, the HomePod has none of that. It doesn't have its own app. It's all kind of like stuffed in the Home app, and it's not very nice, and you have to dig three levels deep to find the home settings and for that speaker. And it would be nice if they did actually like just come out and say, look, now we're supporting the HomePod as an actual platform where the apps run natively on it itself.
Mm-hmm.
Here's also a dedicated HomePod app where you can control all that stuff.
The future of HomePod is apps. How about that?
I mean, it definitely makes sense for them to invest in it, because there are continuing rumors that they are going to do some kind of expansion to the hardware lineup, mm-hmm. some kind of cheaper, smaller version. So lining that up with, you know, big features like adding third-party music services, maybe doing like a proper native app and settings, and, you know, just making it more independent than, oh, it just lives in the Home app. At least it gives them a justification to do it, as well as coming simultaneously with new hardware.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. There's a few things I want to mention about Apple TV Plus this week. The first thing is that the Steven Spielberg produced Amazing Stories series finally has its trailer, and so you can see what this will look like in a release date, right?
Yeah, March 6th it comes out. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks highly produced. like it could be a movie.
And they're only coming out with 5 episodes.
Yeah.
Even though they have a 10-series order, so kind of like the kids shows where they made more episodes than they've released, and they haven't said when the other episodes are coming out. So it's kind of just like hanging in the air, like, we've got 5 amazing stories for you, but we've also got 5 more, but we haven't told you anything about when they're coming.
Yeah. And I watched and finished the Visible Out on Television 5-part documentary series. I think it was about 5 hours long. I just started watching it, and there were some names of people who I like and respect in the documentary, and I got hooked on that like fast. And that was one of the things where I started it on like the Friday when it came out, and by the weekend I was finished. And I haven't had that experience with a whole lot of other Apple TV stuff yet since the original series that first came out, and it's like wanted to get through those as fast as possible. So I liked that, and I recommend that. And you also watched that as well, right?
Yeah. Going into it, I was like, am I going to like this? Is it going to be like, you know, a bit too like laborious? But I enjoyed it. I was like, this is pretty good.
Yep. So more from that I would like to see. Another thing is I was on a podcast this past week called The Icon Garden. And the topic of the podcast is the state of HomeKit. So if you want to hear me talk about HomeKit in depth and what I think about HomeKit, where it's been, and kind of the state of where it is right now, then search for The Icon Garden in your podcast app, or look for the link in the show notes. And it's kind of neat because Adam Justice, who hosts a HomeKit podcast, he's the CEO of ConnectSense. So he literally runs a HomeKit company, or a company that invests in HomeKit hardware. So there were some cool insights from his perspective. And we had a lot of fun recording that. So go and check that out. And the last thing for me is I'm doing a new blog called Space Explored at spaceexplored.com. And so if you follow me on Twitter at ApolloZack, APOLLOZAC, then you know that for the past 3 months or so, I've been heavy into space news and history. And I've been tweeting about space news and history probably a lot more than Apple news and everything. So I finally have a place to put that at spaceexplorer.com. So check that out. I am building it now, and there are new stories there every day. So check that out. And nice. Yeah. And so you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. Check out Space Explored as well. And Mayo, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
All right. And with that being said, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.